You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as the Algerian army continue their attempt to rescue hostages from a gas field in the country's east, we'll have the latest on the operation and a lesson in the rights and wrongs of dealing with hostage situations from a former director of operations with MI6. British Prime Minister David Cameron had this to say earlier.
The action of these extremists can never be justified. We'll be resolute in our determination to fight terrorism and to stand with the Algerian government, who have paid a heavy price over many years fighting against a savage terrorist campaign.
In Tibet, Chinese authorities respond to a gathering wave of self-immolations by criminalising these protest suicides. But is the threat of punishment really likely to deter someone bent upon martyrdom? With the African Cup of Nations kicking off tomorrow afternoon in Johannesburg, we take the cue to discuss the meaning of football in Africa with the director of a film about and the author of a book about that very subject.
They are very, very tough people with a great mentality. And after that, they are full of ambition. Probably because they come from a world where they cannot waste chances to succeed.
And that was, of course, Jose Mourinho. And in New York, we continue to meet the neighbors of our bureau's offices on Broadway.
If you come to this neighborhood, I think you see a lot of stuff that's pretty good. So it's like a reason to come back. And we also have like people just come in from all over the country or all over the world, and we make them a shirt and send them wherever.
All that, plus a further exploration of the theme of the new print edition of Monocle, and more besides, and some music too, all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. So, an action and indeed jam-packed 60 minutes ahead. But first, the headlines with Paul Osborne.
Algerian officials say they still don't have a comprehensive total number of hostages being held at a gas plant in the east of the country. Hundreds of captives were freed after the military moved against militants who were holding them. But it's thought around 30 foreign nationals remain unaccounted for, including people from Japan, Norway, and Britain. Some of the freed captives have been speaking about their experiences.
The army and the gendarmes did a fantastic job, just kept us all nice and safe and fought off the bad guys.
How do you feel now? Okay. Safety?
No, never really felt any danger, to be honest.
Very, very relieved to be out. We still don't know really what's happening.
Yes.
Back on site. Our thoughts are with colleagues that are still there at the moment.
The government in Burma says it's to observe a ceasefire and fighting with ethnic Kachin rebels. It's due to start tomorrow, but rebels haven't yet confirmed that they'll join the truce. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced in almost 2 years of fighting. Doctors treating the artistic director of Russia's Bolshoi Ballet say they may not be able to save his sight after an acid attack. Sergei Filin was attacked outside his home in Moscow on Thursday night. It reportedly followed a two-week campaign of intimidation. The tires on his car had been slashed and his email account had been attacked by hackers. Pakistan has said it will release all Afghan Taliban prisoners, including the group's second-in-command. It follows pressure from Afghanistan, where ministers have said a prisoner release program could help to secure a long-term settlement with the Taliban. Yeah. The U.S. anti-doping agency says Lance Armstrong should give evidence under oath about his use of performance-enhancing drugs. The cyclist used a television interview to admit he cheated in winning all of his 7 Tour de France titles. In Melbourne at the Australian Open, the world's number one tennis player, Novak Djokovic, said Armstrong's actions were a disgrace.
He cheated the sport, he cheated many people around the world. With his career, with his life story, I think they should take all his titles away because it's not fair towards any sportsman, any athlete. He should suffer for his lies all these years.
Hundreds of Orthodox Christians have gathered at the site where they believe Jesus was baptized. The festival of Epiphany is one of the most important in the Orthodox Christian calendar. Rama Mukhatash joined other pilgrims close to the Jordan River.
Today we are gathering here for peace in the world, and especially for Syria. We pray for Syria and the war is happening now in Syria. We wish that everyone here is happy today because it's a great day.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. It's 5 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
The proper Jalabert, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. Fighting appears to be ongoing at a gas plant near in Amanus in eastern Algeria between the Algerian military and a gang of Islamist militants who captured several hundred hostages on Wednesday. Accounts emerging from the desert are unsurprisingly muddled, but it does seem that while most of the hostages, mostly Algerians, have been freed, others, mostly foreign workers, remain unaccounted for. In a moment, we'll speak to Nigel Inkster, Director of Transnational Threats and Political Risk at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, to learn how hostage situations should play out. But first, we cross to Shashank Joshi of the Royal United Services Institute for the latest from Algeria. Shashank, what is the latest you're hearing?
Well, actually, first of all, over the course of the day, it seems that estimates of British casualties in particular have been revised downwards. So while we had that ominous statement from the Prime Minister yesterday suggesting we had to brace ourselves for very bad news, it seems today that the number of Britons at risk has been revised downwards to something like 10. The other bit of news today seems to be that the actual hostage zone was spread right across the compound, and so many of the hostages appear not to have even interacted with their captors at all. And in fact, some of the testimony that's been given to the Daily Telegraph suggests they enjoyed their ordeal, which seems very strange, but it suggests this was experienced very, very differently by different groups within the crisis. And of course, now it's ongoing, and I think the Algerians may have been burnt by their very aggressive tactics yesterday and are proceeding much, much more carefully after being criticized by nearly all of their allies.
Have we learnt anything more about the hostage takers, who they are or what they wanted?
Well, they've made various demands, including some rather strange ones. What you might expect, stopping overflight, a French overflight over Algeria. Other things like the release of Pakistani convicted terrorists in the United States. So some very strange demands made there. The best evidence we still have is that this was, you know, orchestrated at least by Mokhtar Belmokhtar, a veteran of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, but actually someone who had split with the group. So, you know, before we jump to the role of Al-Qaeda, it seems the link there may be a little more tenuous than first thought. So we're still, of course, you know, getting a lot of these details coming in. And, you know, these are notoriously muddled in the early stages, these accounts.
You talk there about them making some slightly strange or incongruous demands, like the one of the release of Pakistani prisoners in the United States. Does that suggest that there is actually a global dimension to this event, or does it suggest that that's the impression that the hostage takers would like to create?
I think it depends what we mean by global dimension, insofar as a local North African jihadist group has global interest and a global vision, or at least is connected to other jihadists elsewhere. Yes, of course, it's global, and they will cross borders, and they, you know, they are catalyzed, motivated by events in other parts of the world. But insofar as there's an operational link to the global jihadist, insofar as there's a line of command to somewhere like Pakistan, or that this is Al-Qaeda core that is issuing orders, planning operations, I think that seems much, much more unlikely at this stage. You know, there's no indication that this is a global in that sense.
You spoke there of how some of the hostages have been freed, actually talking about how they kind of enjoyed the experience. What was it they found enjoyable about it?
Well, you know, well, I found it very bizarre, I have to say, but it seems they were full of praise for the Algerian military, whereas yesterday, of course, we were relatively scathing of Algerian tactics, having used helicopter gunships to apparently launch strafing runs against jeeps transferring hostages. In some other parts of the compound, it seems, the Algerians did relatively well, or at least the British hostages, giving their accounts, suggest they fought very well indeed, and that they were they were very integral to their relief. So, you know, I think we need to still wait for more information here, and particularly to work out what happened yesterday. Did they use helicopters? Did they strafe from the air? And did they attack jeeps holding hostages? And if the answer is yes, I think this will be very, very damaging to the reputation of the Algerian forces for effective hostage crises.
Shashank Joshi of the Royal United Services Institute, many thanks as always. I'm joined now by Nigel Inkster, Director for Transnational Threats and at the Institute for Strategic Studies and former Director of Operations for MI6. Nigel, why, and this is a question I think a lot of people have asked, why did the Algerians go in so hard so quickly?
Well, the simple answer is we don't know. This, you know, most of the reporting that we're getting about this whole incident is second and third hand. And we simply don't know what were the objective factors obtaining at the time that the Algerians went in. There have been reports saying that some of the hostages were trying to break out, hostage takers were trying to break out, and that may have been the catalyst for action. We just don't know.
Leaving aside then the specifics of this situation, which are, as you say, inevitably somewhat muddled, are there hard and fast rules for dealing with a situation of this sort, or are they all as is everyone sort of inextricably different?
Well, I mean, there's not exactly an agreed international convention which determines how you should approach these things. In this country and in a number of other Western countries, the guideline is that everything possible should be done to ensure the safety of hostages and minimize the risk to them. But at the end of the day, each of these situations is different. Each has to be taken on its merits, and everything depends on what information is available about what's happening on the ground in any given set of circumstances.
I mean, there's a litany of broadly similar events that always gets dredged up when a situation like this is unfolding. People think of, you know, great successful hostage rescues like the Israeli raid on Entebbe in 1976, or the various failures down the years, whether it's Munich 1972, Iran 1980, Beslan 2004. How much of the difference between success and failure in this comes down to just luck?
Well, luck is obviously going to play a role in these situations, but I think also training and professionalism and good intelligence collection capabilities all play a role. I don't think that the Algerian military have any particular pedigree in terms of dealing with this kind of hostage crisis. It's not the way they typically operate. So, you know, it seems as if their focus here has been very much on what one might think of as a conventional military response rather than one more characterized by the use of special forces who had been specifically trained for this kind of activity. That said, you know, we're dealing with a very large area, and the more, you know, the bigger the area in which the hostage situation is taking place and the more room for maneuver the hostage takers have, inevitably the more difficult it becomes.
Nigel Inkster of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, former Director of Operations for MI6, many thanks for your time. Coming up, we'll be visiting Tibet to find out if the threat of criminal prosecution is likely to deter protesters willing to set themselves on fire.
For 1 week every January, the world's bankers and financiers, its presidents and finance ministers, its titans of industry, union leaders and economists all head to Davos, a picturesque town on the banks of a beautiful lake and in the shadow of the snow-capped peaks of the Swiss Alps. And this year, Monocle 24 will be there too, broadcasting live from the World Economic Forum. Next Wednesday and Thursday, The Briefing and Midori House will both come live from Davos. Join us as we keep an eye and an ear on the world economy.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in, If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Whatever the rights and wrongs of the cause, there are no dissidents more vexing to established power than those who have chosen martyrdom. Volunteering for death has a way of making any threat or punishment seem somewhat irrelevant. China, at least, appears undeterred by this maddening reality of conflict. In response to a wave of self-immolations by Tibetans who'd like their country back, Beijing is proposing to crack down by such means as arresting the friends and families of the martyrs, confiscating their possessions, and, most chaotically of all, specifically outlawing the suicides themselves, as if someone burning to death is likely to be all that concerned about acquiring a criminal record. Well, joining me now to discuss this further is Roderick Wai, Associate Fellow for the Asia Programme at Chatham House. First of all, what kind of numbers of self-immolations are we looking at in Tibet now?
Well, I'm not sure what exactly the latest figures are, but at the beginning of the year, it was around 97, so it may be more now.
And this has been accelerating?
This certainly has. I mean, it's a few years now that this phenomenon has been in existence, but in this last year, the numbers have increased dramatically.
Well, I wanted to ask why, of all the means of sort of extreme protest, I guess, the Tibetans could enact. Why self-immolation? Is there a heritage in Tibet in the same way that hunger striking has a history among Irish Republicans?
I think this is a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, I'm not aware of any sort of long tradition of self-immolation in Tibet. It is an indication of the despair, in a sense, that many Tibetans feel about their situation.
But isn't this crackdown that China is proposing just likely to inspire still more of them? This is always the problem, I guess, for authorities in dealing with protesters who are willing to take measures like this.
It is. I think the Chinese are trying to do something about this. They are alarmed by the number of these self-immolations, these sacrifices that the Tibetans are making, and they want to find ways to stop it. If they can't stop the individuals themselves, then I think they are looking to punish their families, make sure that people perhaps in the monasteries who have allegedly incited them are also brought into the net of criminal punishment, so that the authorities have a means for wider repression against those people who are self-immolating and their families and associates.
You talk there about the despair that these Tibetans clearly feel, but is there any sort of coherent political agenda underpinning these self-immolations, or are they just, you know, extreme expressions of frustration and rage?
There doesn't appear to be any organisation. They are manifested in many different places. In fact, it's quite interesting that a large number of them have occurred in areas of Tibetan areas that were perhaps among the most assimilated.
That's interesting. Why do you think that might be?
I just don't know. It is just an indication, I think, of the difficulties that the Chinese have in winning hearts and minds. They have long felt that the way to sort of establish their position in Tibet was through economic development, allied with a strong iron fist. But this is simply not working.
Are these self-immolations in Tibet reported at all in the rest of China? Would most Chinese consumers of Chinese media be aware that they were occurring?
They are not hugely publicised. A lot of people are aware of them. There are means other than the official press for getting news out in China. I think this is something that the Chinese authorities, on the whole, wish to not give publicity to. On the other hand, because of the increasing numbers, they want to make their point that it isn't that it isn't individuals, it's actually a plot by splittists led by the Dalai Lama to undermine Chinese rule in Tibet. And when they do publicise these matters, this is the kind of line that they take.
How concerned is Beijing likely to be about how these stories play internationally? Obviously, it doesn't reflect well on China.
It doesn't reflect well on China, and China always takes a very hard line against any manifestations by the international community of support for Tibet, especially support for the Dalai Lama. When foreign politicians meet with the Dalai Lama, there is increasingly a reaction from China, and China's sort of anger against foreign countries for such activities takes longer and longer to abate.
Do you think the fact that, and this may be a bit of a stretch, but do you think the fact that the Arab Spring began with a self-immolation in Tunisia may be making the Chinese a little more nervous about this phenomenon than they might otherwise be?
I suspect not. I mean, they do think about the Arab Spring quite clearly, but they think about that more in the context of mainland China and the way that sort of demonstrations might lead to something bigger in mainland China. In Tibet, I think they see this as a particular set of circumstances. This is not really about sort of democracy or changing the Chinese Communist Party rule. This is about a protest by the Tibetans about the way that they feel that their culture is being eradicated by the Chinese.
And just finally, do you think there may come to a point at which these do escalate into something, well, akin to a Tibetan Spring, if you will, or some sort of large-scale mass revolt?
I think it would be very, very difficult. I mean, we have seen over the years a number of instances of mass protests, often violent protests, in Tibet against the Chinese. I mean, the last Tibetan revolt, if you like, was when the Dalai Lama fled, and that is a long, long time ago. There is just not the means in Tibet to manage a classic revolt against China.
Roderick White of Chatham House, many thanks for joining me. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. We'll be back in a moment to explore the main stories of the week with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, and senior editor, Sophie Grove.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
It's Friday on Midori House, which means it's time to take stock and take a look back at the news stories that have stood out over this week. To help me do that, I'm joined by Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's foreign editor, and Sophie Grove, Monocle's senior editor. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Should we start with what we're not going to talk about?
What are we not talking about?
Well, just because we've already done a little bit of detail at the top of the show. Obviously, I mean, the big story all this week has been Mali and then subsequently Algeria. The one thing I do want to say on that is it's been, from a media point of view, interesting to see how the cuts, the cutting back that a number of media organisations have done over the last 10, 15 years has really, I think, affected how this story's been told.
In that there's clearly a massive story occurring and absolutely nobody's got any idea what's going on.
Exactly. I mean, it's difficult as it is, enough as it is, because this place is in the middle of the desert, middle of nowhere, and it's in the middle of a country, well, the edge of a country, where very few organisations have anyone and have had anyone for years.
Mm. There is a sense, though, that, you know, it's so remote and it's so dangerous. As a journalist, you need a serious, you know, well, kind of experience, but also, you know, security compliment to go out there, unless you're completely incognito, and you do know a few journalists that are hiring off there. But it is interesting because Mali, even from our perspective, Mali is difficult to find people on the ground. I mean, you can see people are coming in, but this story has just been kind of slightly lost. I mean, you could see it being reported at one point. You know, some news networks said everyone had been freed and then came back on and said, actually, they haven't. No. You know, it was excruciating in many senses.
I think also, as Sophie says, it is so remote anyway that even, frankly, if you had a fully staffed Algiers bureau, this would not be the easiest story to talk about. However, I said we weren't going to talk about that.
You lied.
The other stories we want to talk about, big stories from this week, is Boeing, which we've discussed in some detail across the week, and also Lance Armstrong. But Soph's going to talk about Boeing.
Blow by blow, we've covered this because it seems, you know, actually all 50 Dreamliners are now on the ground.
This is an extraordinary calamity for Boeing, isn't it? This is how embarrassing is this on a scale of one to extremely?
Well, as I was just reading, Bloomberg says the Dreamliner has turned into a nightmare. I think
everyone's been trying not to make that joke all week.
Oh, I've made it three or four times.
But yeah. It is. I mean, it's so tricky because it's all down to this battery, which they're now looking at, especially the Japanese probe, which is this kind of lithium ion battery. And it, you know, there's a picture of the battery on most news networks now. It's just mangled. It's, you know, it looks like it's kind of combustible and it leaks when it gets too hot. So a lot of people are saying, is it a bad batch of batteries? It's coming down to this one thing, and people are losing a lot of confidence.
And what's remarkable about this is that if you were to thumb through an old issue of Monocle, the June issue, you'll come to the back and you'll see an expo about the new Boeing 747-8, which I did back then. And you know, we spent a couple of days at the facility in Everett in the US looking at the new plane. Slightly newer than the Dreamliner. And what was incredible is the attention to detail is absolutely as superb as you would hope. It's you go to a factory like this, and if you are in any way scared of flying, you will not be after you've seen the amount of hours, the amount of people, the amount of expertise that goes into everything. And they told me about one tiny, tiny, insignificant problem, a tiny little vibration in one of the wings. And they had a team of some of their best engineers looking at this for several months, just on this tiny problem. It was, you know, just incredible, the attention to detail that they displayed here, which is why I find it so fascinating that a battery has caused such problems.
How do we think Boeing are doing in terms of coping with the PR disaster?
I don't know. It's quite interesting to see the breakdown of some of the companies involved in the construction of the aircraft itself, because I feel that Boeing might be now trying to sort of leak a few other names rather than just Boeing. There's a big article in Reuters about how one third of the aircraft is made in Japan. And then it's really just a list of all of the other companies, distinguished companies that make those components. And then there's another component that's made in Britain. And it's kind of, they're trying to also say, look, this is not just us. It's, you know, it's a collaborative effort. And there's this incredible market domination of something like 80% in Japan that Boeing has for historical reasons. So I think that they have to sort of stay together in that sense. And you can see that the PR is all being directed towards their allies. And then other people like the Qantas have just bailed.
Should we talk about Lance Armstrong?
Oh,
briefly?
Please, let's talk about Lance Armstrong.
So I think actually the most fascinating interview done this week about Lance Armstrong was not the one between Oprah and Lance. Although, if I can just say, in Oprah's defence, she is not a woman to cross. If she's going to give you a proper interview, she does a proper interview. She was very, very good.
Yeah.
As anyone who witnessed her complete evisceration of James Frey, who did the memoir,
indeed,
which wasn't a memoir, do look that up. It's brilliant. But the important one was not Lance's. It was an interview with Nicole Cook, who everyone should know, but most people probably won't, because women's cycling isn't taken as seriously as men, sadly. She's a world champion. She's an Olympic gold medalist. She's just retired, and she used her retirement to absolutely take apart the sport for allowing all this to happen. And as she quite rightly pointed out, Lance Armstrong has committed crimes. He has stolen money. It's fraud, you know. And he should be in jail. And she was quite right. And it's been lost in this sort of, oh, he's apologising, he's saying this. But he's stolen things.
No, I couldn't. I mean, I'm not especially interested in cycling, but I am especially interested in sport. And one of the things I love about sport is that you're supposed to be able to watching it knowing you're not being bilked. That you can't scam it in sport, or at least you're not supposed to be able to. I think he should be, you know, pursued through the streets by an angry mob.
It's quite interesting how seriously they take white-collar crime in the US, and yet, you know, this contrition you're seeing, which is actually, he doesn't look very sorry, especially in that interview, isn't enough. And then, you know, where is the kind of, where is the sort of jail sentence, exactly. I agree, Steve.
We will have more sport and indeed more Steve after the after the news at the bottom of the hour. But for the moment, Monocle's Sophie Grove and Steve Bloomfield, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour of the Monocle Daily, we'll be delving into the new issue of Monocle. Plus, Victor Bueller, director of upcoming film The Beautiful Game, will be joining us in the studio to talk about African football.
Almost every African is the supporter of one or other team.
That's Desmond Tutu in a clip from the film The Beautiful Game. But before we talk more about that, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Around 30 foreign nationals remain unaccounted for after the hostage crisis at a gas plant in eastern Algeria. Hundreds escaped after the Algerian military moved in. Officials in the country say a number of militants remain holed up at the site. The government in Burma has said it's to observe a ceasefire in fighting with ethnic Kachin rebels. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced in almost 2 years of fighting in the north of the country. Doctors treating the artistic director of Russia's Bolshoi Ballet say they may not be able to save his sight after an acid attack. Sergei Filin was attacked outside his home in Moscow on Thursday night. Pakistan has said it will release all its Afghan Taliban prisoners, including the group's second in command. It's come under pressure from Afghanistan, whose ministers say a prisoner release program may help to secure a long-term settlement with the Taliban. And the US anti-doping agency has said Lance Armstrong should give evidence under oath about his use of performance-enhancing drugs. The cyclist used a television interview to admit that he cheated in winning all of his 7 Tour de France titles. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
Ut London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres. Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are back with Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London. This Saturday afternoon, that's tomorrow, South Africa and Cape Verde will kick off in the first match of the 2013 African Cup of Nations, which is being held in South Africa. Football means more than football everywhere it is played, but arguably more so in Africa than anywhere else. Football is the one thing that the entire continent has in common, as even those working for other higher powers are forced to concede.
Soccer has a very, very, very considerable following. It has a following larger than any one religion. Christianity does not have the same number of adherents as there are football supporters. Islam too. Not every African is a Muslim, but almost every African is the supporter of one or other team.
It's the Most Reverend Desmond Tutu, a man who knows when he's beaten. Joining me now to further explore football's importance in Africa is Victor Bueller, director of a new film on that very subject entitled The Beautiful Game, and Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield, also the author of Africa United, How Football Explains Africa, available in all good stores, etc. Welcome, both of you.
Welcome. Thank you.
Victor, first of all, why make a film about football in Africa?
Well, in retrospect, I think I was looking for to find some hope and life in football again. I'm obviously been a Premier League fan for many years and been going to games. But something about football in Africa reminds you that it is actually at the very root of the game. It is the most democratic sport in the world because you need a ball, not necessarily an official ball. You can make a ball out of plastic bags. You know, that happens a lot across Africa. And you just need some open space. And a whole community can come together just on the basis of that. And so I think reconnecting to that was really ultimately my inspiration to make the film.
And Steve, your book is subtitled How Football Explains Africa.
You're going to ask me how football explains Africa, aren't you?
I was going to ask exactly that question.
I think you can tell an awful lot about a country through its football, and nowhere more so than in Africa. I remember when I moved to Nairobi in 2006, I was at the Africa correspondent for the Independent newspaper here in the UK. And I was trying to understand what was happening in Kenya and trying to understand Kenyan politics. And as a football fan, I thought I'd go and watch some Kenyan football and try to understand what was happening in Kenyan football. And there was this really confusing thing where at the time I was there, there were two rival Kenyan Premier Leagues who both had exactly the same teams in them. And essentially you had two rival political factions who were running the different leagues and insisting that, oh, no, our league is the real league. And the more I understood what was happening in Kenyan football and the power structure behind that and the issues over wealth and over land and over ethnicity, the more I understood exactly what was going on in Kenyan politics. It was a mirror image. And everywhere I went across the continent, it was the same thing. If you understood the issues that were affecting football, then you understood the issues that were affecting the country as a whole.
And was that your experience, Victor? Did you find all over Africa that football was politics played by other means?
Yeah, very much so. In fact, you can almost gauge the success of African football teams by how well their FAs are run. And almost, you can take it one step further, certainly by the infrastructure that needs to be there. Like if you look at Ghana, for instance, Ghana is probably one of the more successful countries of late in Africa, and it's no coincidence that its football team has matched that success. And even certainly there's blips on the way. I mean, look at Mali and the Ivory Coast. There's something about the way a football FA is run and the relation to that and to how successful its team is on the field in Africa, above all else, that certainly you realise quite quickly when you get there.
Did you find the football and the football cultures varied significantly across Africa?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I don't think you can treat Africa as a single country. In fact, I think a lot of us from the West kind of, in a way, begin with that perception. I don't know where that comes from exactly. But when you get into it, you realise that there are very, you know, the nuances are quite bold. But certainly one thing that every African nation shares is just that incredible love for the game. It really is much more a part of everyday life than even here, even when I've traveled in South America. You know, Brazil's always talked about the sort of home of football, and it is, of course. It's produced so many great players and so much passion for the game. But in Africa, you just turn a corner, every corner, and there's football being played. And I just don't know quite where you see the same. The only thing I ever compared it to is maybe cricket in India, where people.
I was just going to raise exactly that comparison. Yeah, on any flat surface. When the weather permits, you see people playing cricket.
You're almost disappointed when there's a flat surface and open space and there's no game being played. Well, what's going on? But that rarely happens. And in fact, Steve and I, we met at a World Cup qualifying game, Ivory Coast.
Was it Burkina Faso?
I think it was against Burkina Faso. Maybe Benin.
We all spent several days hanging out at the Gulf Hotel, this sort of five-star place. We weren't staying there, I hasten to add, but it was where the Ivory Coast team were playing. Sort of talking to the fans, some of the coaches, and then doing our best to try and convince some of the stars like Didier Drogba and Kolo Touré and Yaya Touré and Emmanuel Eboué to do interviews. We bonded over coffees in the lobby of the Gulf Hotel, waiting for these footballers to show up.
It's true. Our hair grew long trying to chase football players to get to sit down for interviews.
Yeah. Victor, your film isn't an unqualified hymn of praise to African football. It does also address corruption in the sport. We have a clip dealing with that.
So one day I had a match. The evening before, my manager came to me and told me, "You want $2 million? I said, "What kind of question is that? Who don't want $2 million? What must I do for it?" "You must only win 1-0 from Greece." Big people who gamble with each other, once Nigeria, only to win 1-0. I said, how can I do that? I cannot tell my players you may not score more. So I said, forget it.
How big a problem is this, do you think, in African football?
Well, I hate to say, I mean, certainly it's a problem. And what you heard there was Clements Westerhoff, who's the former Nigerian coach, being offered a talking about being offered a bribe. I do think it's a problem. However, I have to say, I think it's a systemic problem in football, international football, across the board. And, you know, you can look at Africa, and certainly in many ways the corruption there is more exposed than elsewhere. But it's part of a larger system that I think comes down from the top. And I think you have to follow it to the top. And unfortunately, that means FIFA and well, we know where
exactly.
This goes.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two issues here. One is it's about weak governance and not having a strong press. So weak governance and weak press. And this is the same in terms of, to go back to what we were saying at the start about how you can tell so much about a country through
its
football.
This is football as a metaphor for
exactly.
Africa again, isn't it?
If you have a situation where there's no oversight, there's no transparency of your FA, where there is no real culture of investigative journalism that's well-funded, then people can get away with this. And we see this in all sorts of countries all over the world where you have those things in common. But it is a very serious problem in Africa. And then the second part of that is, of course, as Victor says, you have a global football structure with FIFA, who run the game, that is not interested in any way in dealing with corruption anywhere. And many of the leading figures in FIFA have their own corruption allegations hanging over them.
Is it the governance, do you think? Because it's one of the things that it gets talked about in the build-up to every World Cup, and especially the last World Cup but one in South Africa, is just like, is this the time that an African team is going to go all the way or nearly? Is the reason it doesn't quite happen, is it largely to do with bad governance, or is African football not quite there yet?
Well, that's an ineffable question, because definitely the talent is there. And I think certainly the resources and... I mean, one problem that many African countries have is that their best players tend to leave fairly early. And so they're tapping into a pool even more so than, you know, obviously a lot of great English players play in, you know, European leagues. But in Africa, in a way, getting every African player together again to practice, to train, can be tricky. But there's no question that bad governance, not enough resources, have held back some very talented players from going on to win trophies.
And just finally, from each of you gentlemen, who's going to win the African Cup of Nations?
well, I was just saying to Victor before that I've put a sneaky little outside bet on Cape Verde, who I think are still available about 70-1. So a very outside bet. But they beat Cameroon, who have historically been very good, to reach the finals. I think they're unlikely to win, but I think could surprise people. If I had to choose a country that I really want to win, then it has to be Ivory Coast. They haven't won it since 1992. This generation of players, with Drogba, with the Touré brothers, with several others as well, like Gervinho and Eboué, they really deserve to win it, but they've been cursed.
And Victor?
Well, I appreciate that Steve loves an underdog, so Cape Verde is definitely going to be fun to watch. But yeah, you have to go for Ivory Coast. Is definitely the most talented team. And yeah, it's just eluded them for all this time, all these great years with Drogba and the Touré brothers. Could this be the year?
Victor Bueller, director of The Beautiful Game and Monocle's foreign editor and author of Africa United. Steve Bloomfield, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we will be asking how to revive a forgotten neighbourhood. But first, we'll stay in Africa with a song from The Very Best. This is Julia from The Very Best's EP, Warm Heart of Africa. Julia. That was The Very Best with Julia. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
We love to champion retailers who make a point of differentiating themselves from other offerings on the high street. Our latest Monocle briefing film travels to Buenos Aires, New York, and Budapest to visit specialist shops where making is at the heart of their retail offering.
One of the big challenges with any denim brand or any brand for that matter is to really try and explain to the customer why it's special, why it's unique, and why it's worth investing, you know, a lot of money in a great product.
You can view handmade retailers and over 300 more films and slideshows on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 1845 here in London. The new edition of Monocle magazine, which is on a newsstand near you now or now about, meets people in a variety of fields who've actually gone and done the things that many of us might consider going and doing, but never quite go and do, for whatever reason. These people had so much to say that was useful and interesting that we thought we'd pester a few of them for further insights. And tonight it's the turn of Mark Smith, editor-in-chief of Time Out Amsterdam and a regular contributor to Monocle, to tell us what he's learnt about developing a neighbourhood. Mark, welcome to the show. First of all, introduce Noord, your neighbourhood of Amsterdam.
Well, Noord is the polar opposite of the Amsterdam cliche of clogs and canal houses. It's fair to say that if you're looking for picture postcard vistas, then you're not going to find them in Noord. It's the post-industrial district of the city. And it's really coming to into its own at the moment, precisely because it's such a contrast to the city proper.
So what was Noord like, say, 5 or 10 years ago, and what's it like now?
Well, it was interesting that you referred to it as a forgotten district, because there's actually a song about Noord, quite a pejorative one, which refers to the district as the God-forgotten Noord. I'd say that it's gone through three stages, to be honest. It used to be likened to a penal colony, with the typical Dutch directness. It was 80% social housing. It then went through a sort of poor but sexy phase, a little bit like Berlin. And now the investment is coming, and it's absolutely taking off. There's a real energy there.
How much support did you need from local government, and how did you go about getting it?
Well, I'm unfortunately not the person that made Noord happen, but it's widely credited to a woman called Ava de Klerk, who saw the potential of the shipbuilding yards in Noord. And in a very collaborative Amsterdam way, she worked with local government to create an area called Art City in a network of these shipbuilding hangars. And it's still thriving today, 10 years afterwards. And what's nice about this is that the impetus isn't just coming from artists. It's not just coming from the local government. Everybody is very much working together to kickstart this area.
I mean, how did the people who made Noord happen go about persuading people to move there and open businesses there? It's always difficult to convince those first pioneers.
To be honest, you take the ferry. There's a free ferry from behind Central Station, and the city just transforms before your eyes. Lots of people say that it's Amsterdam is one of the most heavily densely populated places in Europe, and there's just an atmosphere about Noord which is really inspiring, and it's really a canvas at the moment for people to think big. I mean, quite literally.
Do you think there are any specific lessons from what was done in Noord that could be applied to urban regeneration anywhere?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, don't believe the hype, if you know what I mean. I mean, it really was a very disparaged area of town. And actually, recently I went on a tour of an exciting new development in Noord, which is Box Park. It's the second international, it's the first international iteration of the mini mall that started in Shoreditch in London. And actually, the guy who started Box Park, Roger Wade, told me that he could feel that energy that he felt in East London 15 years ago. And that's a very exciting thing to hear.
Mark Smith, editor-in-chief of Time Out Amsterdam, thank you very much for joining us. We will be back after this with a frankly grotesque and gratuitous exercise in name-dropping. Stay tuned.
And by the name dropping, it means that I just wanted to say that earlier today I did actually have morning tea of a sort with the subject and or inspiration for this very next song. She claims she's only ever heard it once, and that was by accident in a shop in Adelaide. This is First Aid Kit with Emmy Lou. First Aid Kit with Emmy Lou, their tribute to Emmy Lou Harris. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. And today, for our weekly Meet the Neighbours segment, Monocle's Barrett Austin visited Vincent Nasebacht, owner of The Sock Hop, a short stroll from our New York bureau. Nasebacht's store, which opened in 2010, specialises in luxurious, mostly imported socks, and also makes custom shirts, a craft which has been in his family for four generations.
Two things we do a lot are socks and custom shirts. We have socks that are mostly taken in from European brands, and they're generally like higher natural fiber content and more fitted, and I like a nicer sock for a nicer shoe sort of thing. Some of the brands I really like are Bresciani is an Italian brand and Falca is a German brand. And I think what's makes them really nice is they have a bunch of different materials that they use, and they kind of do have different purposes, like summer weights, winter weights. I wear nice shoes, I'm on my feet all day. It's like in New York, or you just generally walk around all the time, something you kind of do think about. And I think that it just kind of goes hand in hand. I think we have a lot of customers that kind of come in one time and they're like, uh-huh. And then they come back another time, like, okay, now I know what I'm doing. Sometimes some of the brands that like we carry, you know, they tell other people about it. A lot of times it's just like stores or whatever, but if it's a sock store, they're like, go to the sock store. And they come in, and it's just kind of different, I think, from their expectations too. Started this project, the whole thing, about 2.5 years ago when I was trying to open. I wanted custom shirts because it's been in our family for a long time and it's just kind of something we'd like to pass down to, you know, next generation too. So my brother Ted is under my dad, but we weren't able to get that going because it involved moving a lot of people from Chicago. So we kind of brought that in once the sock store was already going. But see that in the back of the shop, we actually make all the stuff. So the really industrial machine there is a buttonhole machine. That's loud and it's nice. And then this other one here is a straight machine. And then there's like a serger and some other stuff, but it's pretty simple. I mean, it's my dad remembers sewing and then the motors came in. If you come to this neighborhood, I think you see a lot of stuff that's pretty good. So it's like a reason to come back. And we also have like people just come in from all over the country or all over the world, and we make them a shirt and send them wherever. And the time that we've been in this neighborhood has changed kind of like a little and then a lot, and change is constant. It's kind of like more additive businesses. Like people that want to like open a business around here are, it's like a store, but it's not like on Broadway. It's a completely different neighborhood. Like it seems like it'd be really heavy foot traffic area, but it's kind of like east enough of Broadway and Lafayette that it's pretty remote. We're standing in front of a wall of socks right now. Mostly these are like really soft wools from Bresciani because it's January. So we have a lot of like seasonal fabrics. Like these are a bunch of cashmere right here. I've been wearing this 100% cashmere all winter. You know, I have them sitting around, so I do indulge. This one's really cool. It's a Falca walkie sock. It's double padded on the bottom. I wear them a lot because it's like wearing an extra insole. So a lot of guys that work in the restaurant industry around the neighborhood wear them. Like that's all they wear. If somebody comes in and they say, why would I want any of these socks? I'll like generally put them in like a walkie if they want to try one sock because it is just so uniquely different. But if you're wearing like nice shoes, you come in, you're like, I have this problem. A lot of people do. Like there's generally a way to address it, to alleviate some of the tension or stress, whatever. You know, I'm in here a lot. Like I don't want to sell somebody something that's not good and have them tell me it's not good. Like I have no interest in that. So I want people to be happy with what they get. So it has to be good and we have to like it. it's a lot of fun. It's like being a saloon owner or something. It's just the vibrancy of the local neighborhood, and then New York on top of that. You know, it's just multiple levels of weirdness.
And that was Barrett Austin from our New York bureau talking to Vincent Nassebart, purveyor of a classier sock and owner of the Sock Hop in New York. And that's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thanks to producer Alan John, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and studio manager Chris Fitch. Next up, Marcus Hippie will be finding about Buenos Aires' latest trend of closed-door restaurants in the menu.
The main idea of this closed-door restaurant concept, it's like to have a fixed menu that you can change almost every week or every month, and to work just with the reservations.
And 3 hours from now, that's 2200 hours here in London, Ted Kravitz and Dom Reynolds will be here for the Monocle Daily. But for now, from me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.